ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and Happy New Year. Welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast, the first Studcast of 2019. We are very happy to have you here. It is my pleasure to be here. I am the great Ryan Last, and once again, we have a great show in store for you as the Tennessee Stud. He's going to go down that road of wrestling history, sharing his personal tales and anecdotes with us here this week. And without any further ado, let's get to the man of the hour, the host of the Studcast, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Brian, and all our listeners out there. And thank them very much for being listeners and for coming back each week, week after week. And we certainly appreciate it. Our growth is good. We've got a lot of people that are, I guess you call them loyal fans, that just really, really like to hear the old time stories. And it's just great to be in 2019. I look forward to what's going to happen in this year, how far I'll be able to get with my family's history and my own history, and really look forward to it.
Well, before we look forward, let's take a short step back for a second, because I want to thank, and I know you want to thank, all the listeners. The reaction to the last two episodes, the last two Studcasts dealing with your 10 steps to building a championship territory, has been overwhelming. We knew people would like it, but I have to say, I was a little bit surprised by how much people liked it, Ron. What did you think of the reaction you saw to those episodes?
Oh, just tremendous. I mean, tremendous amount of comments. I've had a hard time keeping up with all of them and trying to answer people and get back to them. And it's been, but that's a good problem. I really like that. And, I think that really sets us up well today for today's episode. Cause, I want to return back to Florida and particularly start in February 1974, because the last time before we did the 10 steps at those two Studcasts, we were talking about it then, January 1974. And, 1974 in February, things are beginning to take shape for an unprecedented historic run of success in Florida. And in the coming weeks, we're going to analyze who, how, and what happens in the NWA territory to light it on fire that makes Florida just take off. And so if you don't care, my man, I'm going to jump right into her here.
Go right ahead, Ron. We're all looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
All right. As we talked about in Studcast number 74, about three episodes back, my father, Buddy Fuller, had joined the ownership team of the Florida Territory with Eddie Graham. And Eddie obviously was the man who had brought Florida into the spotlight of the NWA and the wrestling world. Significant decisions are going to be made in early 1974 that's going to drive business to a point never considered before by ownership or anybody else, fans, anybody else in Florida. What's about to happen is just earth-shaking, really. Obviously, hiring Bill Watts as a booker is going to bring in a lot of talent to the state, and he's going to provide an angle that's going to catapult wrestling in Florida into uncharted waters. Just a quick review. Let's look back at episode 75 just briefly, the one that introduced the 10 steps to building the championship territory. And we discussed Bill's move to eliminate wrestlers from the Florida crew and add wrestlers at an alarming rate in January and February 1974. For those people that might not have heard that episode, Just want to bring them up to date. These were some of the people that were eliminated in January and early February of 1974. Mad Dog Vachon, Paul LeDuc, Danny Hodge, Haystacks Calhoun, Tex McKenzie, Bob Orton Sr., and Ann Jr., Dennis Stamp, Ali Vasari, Frank Martinez, Skull Von Stroheim. I mean, that's just a few. That's not all of them. There's a lot of guys going out. And at that same time frame, Watts is going to add in February, Gary Hart, Kevin Sullivan, Tony Charles, Buddy Roberts, Jerry Brown, the Hollywood Blondes, who's managed by Sir Oliver Humperdinck, and then obviously himself. He's going to be adding himself to the crew. So obviously the foundation is set by February, certainly by March in 1974. The foundation is pretty much set, and there are still, at this point, stars headed to Florida. Now let's talk about the angle I've alluded to earlier that's going to catapult Florida wrestling into the uncharted waters. In 1974, a star is going to emerge from this angle, and he's going to carry the banner of Florida wrestling for years to come, just as the great Jack Briscoe did for many, many years before this guy. This wrestler was not new to the state. He hadn't been there since 1969. He's always been a heel and a very good one. With heels, the more despised you become and the more heat you produce as a heel will only serve to make you more popular when and if you are turned babyface. In 1974, this guy I'm speaking about, obviously, is Dusty Rhodes. And he's going to go from being a powerful heel to being the most prolific, loved, respected, and admired wrestler of all time in Florida. I don't think anybody, including Jack Briscoe, would ever be able to claim that he became more popular than Dusty. And a lot of times that happens when you have a heel. When you turn him, he's going to be your top baby face. It's just about always that way, and especially if it's done right. And in Dusty's case, this turn is going to really be done right. In the coming weeks, we're going to attempt to tell the story of how one man wins the hearts of thousands of existing wrestling fans and at the same time attract thousands more to the sport. That's exactly what Dusty does in this run. He's not the first to turn heel from heel to babyface, but this turn is going to explode the fan base and change Florida wrestling forever.
You got to see firsthand how effective Dusty was with Dick Murdoch and on his own as a heel. You had been around him since at least 1970. And of course, fans of the Studcast may remember your legendary story of Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes in the Bahamas and the chaos they caused when they killed the town. But all that time you had seen him and been around him, did you ever think that he would be an effective babyface? Was it apparent to you, or was it something where he was such a good heel that you thought that was what he should be throughout his career?
Well, not in the early days. In 1970, when I went there, I would have never thought that he would have been a good babyface. But Dusty, I think the longer he was there, he maintained his heat because they kept pushing him as a heel. But people just began to like him. There's something about Dusty that's different than most guys in the ring. And he was experiencing that in Florida. And I think that's probably why Bill Watts saw it, because he hadn't been there. And when he arrives, he can see that Dusty is maybe the perfect guy to make a move with. And obviously his plans for his crew are going to work around that. So it all makes sense. And Dusty goes and makes this deal up. Hell, let's just take over. Let's meet Virgil Riley Reynolds Jr. that is Dusty Rhodes. And he was born on October 11th, 1945, in Austin, Texas. The son of a plumber man, as he used to love to say. He used that phrase quite a bit. He's going to be 6 feet one, about 6'1", and around 290 pounds by the time he steps into a wrestling ring. I want to go back to his high school days. He graduated from a high school in Fort Worth, Texas, Arlington Heights High School, and he played baseball and football there. He attended West Texas State University, which I call the wrestling factory because so many wrestlers came out of that college. It's just really amazing. And there at West Texas, he played both sports again. And And that's where Dusty met the guys that's going to influence his future the most. And I'm talking about the Funk Brothers, obviously, Dory and Terry. Stan Hansen goes to college there. Bobby Duncan, and many other future wrestlers that play football are going to come out of there and go into the ring. That was just it was a factory for producing great wrestlers, and Dusty was certainly no example of no exception to it. After his college days, he tries to make a career out of playing pro football. He tries out for the American Football League team in Boston, the Boston Patriots. He doesn't make that team, but he does get on the Hartford Charter Oaks football team, which I'd never heard of. It's in the Continental Football League, or it was. Now, that team's going to fold in his first season, and he's going to return to Texas in 1967. When he goes back to Texas, he's going to meet Joe Blanchard. Joe Blanchard is a respected and talented pro wrestler and the father of Tully Blanchard, of Four Horsemen fame. And he also has a daughter that's a great wrestler as well. Joe trains him. Joe Blanchard trains him. And Virgil, I'm going to call him Virgil. When you know Dusty well, he doesn't get upset with that. And I met Dusty when he was pretty much Virgil more than he was Dusty. He's probably, when he's being trained, would be considered one of the most unlikely to succeed wrestlers, maybe of all time. He's going to certainly far surpass everyone's expectations when it comes to being a star. When Virgil finishes his training, he spots an ad. This is crazy, in a Boston paper. I don't know how he lands his hands on a Boston paper, but the promoter there, Tony Santos, is actually advertising for wrestlers, which is just crazy. I don't know how anybody does that. I've never heard of anybody doing that before, but Dusty sees this, and Dusty talked to me about it, and he says he takes off for Boston. When he gets there, he sits down with Tony Santos, and as any promoter would do, he doesn't know Dusty. He's never heard of him. Dusty's a really young guy. It's his first job, basically. He asks him a lot of questions. And Dusty bluffs his way or bullshits his way. And knowing Dusty as I do, that's probably what it was, into Santos's crew by mentioning guys like Bobby Duncan and the Two Funks. The brothers, and probably Dory Sr. too, I'm sure. Santos is very familiar with all those boys from out there, and Dory Sr., obviously. So when he gets there, he begins his career as Dusty Runnels. He doesn't even use the name Rhodes, and he quickly gets a spot against Frank Scarpa, who is the BTW World Heavyweight Champion in the Boston Arena. Dusty told me this story himself. When I first met him, we talked one day, and I kind of asked him, when you got started, man, how did that go? Where'd you go? And he tells me about this going into Boston, and he tells me about his first Thanksgiving there. I think it's his only Thanksgiving there, as a matter of fact. But he says that first Thanksgiving in wrestling that he spent every night while he was there sleeping in his car. He never had a home. He never had an apartment. He never had a place as long as he was there, except for his car to sleep in. And he told me that on Thanksgiving one time, he ate Thanksgiving dinner with a new buddy of his who happens to be Rufus R. Jones, who's a great friend of mine. And they had their Thanksgiving dinner in a Boston soup kitchen. That certainly kind of, to me, lends credence to his future claims as being a common man. Dusty came from nothing and turned into be a marvelous, marvelous performer in the ring. And basically, far from being a common man, he's pretty much an astounding individual.
From what I remember, Dusty didn't spend too long in Boston, correct?
That's right. He did not make it there very long at all. And he goes right back to Texas again. Santos's company was called Big Time Wrestling. in Boston. And he's going to go back to another big-time wrestling company in Dallas. And that's going to become World Class Championship Wrestling. Obviously, that's Fritz Von Erich. And Fritz welcomes him there in 68, puts him in his crew. And it's here that Dusty's going to become not Dusty Runnels anymore, but the real Dusty Rhodes. That's going to become his name from then on. And he's going to meet Gary Hart there for the first time. And that's kind of prophetic that, you know, this combination of Dusty and Gary Hart are going to change wrestling forever 6 years later in the state of Florida. Gary Hart's going to see the potential in him. And he talks Fritz into allowing Gary to team Dusty up with Don Jardine, the Spoiler. And then Hart obviously wants to manage him. So Jardine's a veteran, and he has a great influence on the development of a young guy like Dusty. You know, Dusty says Don Jardine taught him a whole lot, man, and he really has great things to say about Jardine. Later that same year, Dusty's going to leave Dallas for Giggles, Kansas City territory, and he's going to meet his future partner there, Dick Murdoch. They're going to form a team, call themselves what else but the Texas Outlaws. Now, that's the most appropriate name I ever saw for two crazy Texans like those two right there. That is a perfect moniker for them.
And of course, Ron, that tag team would become quite legendary, and they would hit many territories within just a few years. They were really all over the place.
They did. It's just exactly that. They blow through many, many territories. And Dusty said that himself, that, you know, they got around quite a bit. They worked, obviously, once they leave Kansas City, they're going to work the Amarillo territory for the Funks. They're going to go work in Detroit, the NWA territory in Detroit for the Sheik. They're going to work and become big stars in Gagne's territory in Minneapolis. They're going to work the IWE in Japan. And then they're going to end up in Australia. And all this is in the period of maybe less than 2 years. And in Australia, they're going to become Barnett's tag team champions. And as they do in many other places where they go, you know, I mean, they're two young guys that are clicking, and they really got a great persona, and they got it going really, really good. Now, we're talking about Australia. I got to tell you a story that Jim Barnett told me this story himself. And we were talking about Dusty and Murdoch because in 1970, this is later than 1970, and Jim tells me, he goes, "Ronald, I have a story for you about these two boys." And I said, "Okay, well, what is that, Jim?" And he goes, "Well, you know," he says, They like to drink, and they work big dressers, Ron. You know that. And he goes, I'm walking down the street in King's Cross, and there's a section of Sydney in which the wrestlers lived in hotels there in that particular district. Most of them never got apartments. They only there 2 months, sometimes 3 months or less. So he says he's walking down the street in King's Cross, and out of a bar staggers his the way Jim put it is, he goes, I'm walking, and out staggers Dick Murdoch and Dusty Rhodes. They're wearing Bermuda shorts and t-shirts with holes in them, and he says, and they have my championship belts around their waist. And so I said, "Well, Jim, what did you do?" And he said, "Well, you know how I am," he says. "I said to them, oh boy, there, look at my champions. They are so well dressed, aren't they?" And he said, "I just went on." So, you know, I mean, those guys really didn't care. They were having a good time every day. And when you're in Australia and you're in that King's Cross district down there, it's a really good place to have a good time. And I don't really blame those guys for doing so there.
Barnett kind of insisted on his wrestlers dressing professionally, though, didn't he?
That's what he said. You know, I mean, you know, that's what he was making that comment because he had told people, usually at that opening meeting when a new crew comes on board, he pretty much lays out, "I want you to do this, I want you to do that." And that's why when he saw them, when they bumped into him, they actually almost knocked him down, according to him. And then they went like, "Oh, gosh, it's Barnett." And then, you know, it was like, and then he says, "Oh, my champions, look at you." You know, I mean, it was like, he was just, he was laying it out there for him. And, Jim was a great character, but those two guys were great characters as well. So basically, as we have covered here, they're just everywhere. They're all over the world in a 1 to 2 year time frame, and then they're going to arrive in Florida in '69 as the Texas Outlaws. Now I'm going to begin working with them in '70 when I come to Florida after I've only been working for 6 months. And they're going to work as a team in Florida until about 73 when Murdoch is going to leave the territory. And it's at that point that Dusty separates from being a tag team partner for much of his early career with Jardine, with Murdoch. And he's going to turn into a star of his own by going single. That's a pretty big adjustment for a guy that's been in a lot of tags, but he's mature at this point. He's had quite a few years in the business, and it's time for him to become a star. And that's exactly what he's going to do. In my opinion, he's a very unlikely star with a body, an unlikely babyface star for sure, with a body like Dusty had. Most people would not consider Dusty to be a heck of an athlete. He is a pretty darn good athlete, though. Obviously, he played baseball and football in college, and he, for a big guy, he could move. He could get around when he wanted to. He could really get it done. Dusty, he always had a bigger midsection. I'm going to call it that, than most wrestlers. And on that stomach, he had that large, big red birthmark that was unique. And that's what I think helped make Dusty Dusty. Was that biggest big stomach, the big birthmark. He was identifiable. Even if you couldn't see his head, you knew who that was. In 1974, he's going to build his future career around what other people call charisma. But to Dusty, it wasn't charisma, it was chrisma. And he used to always say it in his interviews, and I always liked it. I mean, I didn't know if he really knew that it was charisma, or he just liked to use that shortened term, charisma, because he really did have charisma. And he'll develop a unique relationship and appeal to the common man as he goes forward. And he called them and endeared himself to the blue-collar America. He called them the common man. Everybody out there he spoke to was the common man. And they loved him. The blue-collar America people really loved Dusty. And he made all that really stick and be important and sold it through his phenomenal interviews. He was just maybe one of the best ever on the mic. From 1964 on, his career had no limits. And he made himself one of the brightest stars in American wrestling history.
Dick Murdoch was one of the best workers of his era, and when he really wanted to, he may have been the best. Like I said, when he really wanted to, because sometimes he liked to have a good time in there. But to the people who maybe only saw Dusty in the mid-80s or the late 80s, when he was older, when he had gained some weight, early on in his career, when you first saw him, when you first start working with him, how was he in the ring?
Oh, he was a mover. He was a grinder and a mover, and so was Murdoch. And you're right, Dick Murdoch had great, great ability in the ring and could have really gone places had he had a different mindset than what he had. Dusty's mindset was better than Dick's. He wasn't so playful as Dick in the ring sometimes. And Dusty, I think, was driven to be somebody. And I don't know that Dick had that drive within him, but what a fabulous team they were. And I loved to work with them. They were up and down and a lot of high spots and back and forth. Those guys worked hard, and it was a real pleasure. And not just a pleasure, because I'm young at this point. I'm in my first year. And just to have the opportunity to get in the ring with guys like that just makes it unbelievable for you. You can't put enough emphasis on how important it is to have opportunity to work with guys of that caliber.
I know that we just did his background, and obviously in the weeks ahead, we'll discuss the intricacies of his babyface turn, because it is one of the biggest moments in wrestling history, certainly in the state of Florida. But when you go back now and you look, Ron, and you think about some of the guys that were on the roster, some of the guys you've been talking about for the last several months here on the Studcast, whether it's Jack Briscoe, whether it's Dale Lewis, whether it's Bob Roop, guys with legitimate collegiate or amateur wrestling backgrounds. It was a major shift to go from that being your top star, that kind of wrestler, to Dusty Rhodes. At the time, was it controversial in the locker room? What did guys think of making the switch from a Jack Briscoe or a Jack Briscoe caliber wrestler to a Dusty Rhodes?
Well, I tell you what, you know, when that happened, territory was already in good shape. But when that happened, it just ignited business. And I don't think anybody would have had the guts to complain about Dusty at that point. I mean, Dusty just got over big time. And when that happened, so did their paychecks all get bigger at the end of the week. And I don't think anybody thought that. Now, I think your point here and other wrestlers' points well taken, this Florida territory has been based upon wrestling pretty much all the time, 100%. Since the day Eddie came there and probably back into Cowboy Zoletro's day. So this is a big move for them. And I'm sure the people that would have questioned it the most would have been my dad and Eddie.
And then one last question before we move on, Ron, and that is Bill Watts, when he was on the Super Studcast. And of course, that's available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. He talked about when he first went in there, he thought that Dusty was going behind his back to complain about his booking to Eddie, and he fired him. And of course, it didn't last, but it was more to make a point to Dusty where, look, I'm the boss now. You can't do this. You can't go behind my back. You can't complain to Eddie. And things got fixed. Things got regulated from that point forward. And he raves about what it was like to have Dusty work for him from that point going forward in Florida. You hear things about later on in his life, certainly when he became a booker and a much bigger star than he was here. Were there any ego issues with Dusty that you heard in the locker room at this time?
Not in 74. No. I think Dusty was just blown away by what happened. I don't think he had any expectations, and if he did, they weren't big, about what happens once they turn him babyface. I think it surprised everyone in Florida, from the fans all the way to Eddie and my father that owned part of the company, of just how big Dusty became. And, you know, I never had any dealings with him after 74. Later on in this year, 1974, I'm going to get into my own wrestling company, and I'm really not going to see Dusty. I don't think I probably see Dusty after 1974 more than two or three times, the rest of my life, the rest of his life. So I didn't have an opportunity to see him after he started booking, after he went to Crockett, how he was in WCW, wherever that he worked and went, you know, back in Florida after that, after Crockett. I don't know about those, and I can't be honest with you on that. I can't tell you. But I know in 74, he was still a humble dude, having a great time, that had just so much talent and so much charisma, as he used to say. And he just exploded Florida. There's no doubt about it.
We will be back in just one moment, and we will continue our dive into 1974 wrestling in Florida. But first, listen to this.
The Lost Territory, Southeastern and Continental Wrestling DVDs are on fire around the world at tnstud.com. Click Stud Store. Only $39.99. Own your piece of classic wrestling history with the 5-pack First Collector's Edition with 12 hours, 5 DVDs, 67 matches, early 1970s bonus matches, and a different present-day interview with the Tennessee Stud on every DVD. Everything from Armstrong's to the Stud's Zukov. These are old-school memories at tnstud.com, $39.99 with free shipping. And don't miss the next Super Studcast number 13, one of the most requested Super Studcast ever, as the Stud finally has his say about one of the most destructive wrestling wars of all time. His Knoxville Southeastern Wrestling War is pure wrestling history and released on Tuesday, December 15th. Happy New Year, and thanks for supporting the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Well, there you hear it. So much going on in the world of the Studcast and the Tennessee Stud. Of course, the next Super Studcast, which will be coming at you on January 15th, all about the Knoxville Wrestling War. This is a story that has been seldom told. Ron has not spoken much about this in all the many years since everything went down in 1979. So we're going to hear about that, but also I want to remind everyone, the brand new Southeastern Continental DVD set, the collector's edition, The Lost Territory, 5 DVDs, only $39.99, including shipping. Who does that? Who includes shipping? The Tennessee Stud, that's who. Get those at tnstud.com. But Ron, before we get back to the story of 1974 in Florida, this is going to be one of the few times that you've spoken about the Knoxville War in public. Are you ready to tell your side of that story?
Yeah, I guess I am. It's only been about 30 years, I guess. You know, we're nearing 30 years since all that went down. And I guess after 30 years, it's probably time for me to speak up and at least let people know. Pretty much a lot of people that were involved in that, Bob Roop, I know for sure. I think Ronnie Garvin. I don't know about Orton Jr., you know, but I do know that Roop and Garvin have had the opportunity to talk to all different types of people about their side of the story. And I never felt the necessity to do it in all the years that once I left there and I was being successful. And I just turned my back on it and tried to forget it. But I have had so many fans ask me over the years, what is my side of the story? And we're going to do that. On January, Tuesday, January 15th, I'm going to lay out how I saw it go down in 1979. And we're going to have to back up beyond earlier than 1979 to get that whole story in and kind of lay the foundation for what went on and what happened. And I think fans will be amazed at my version of it compared to what others have said.
It is certainly one of the most anticipated Super Studcasts we've ever had. Once again, it will debut on Tuesday, January 15th, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 to get all this information. And for all you patrons of the Studcast, stay tuned because I think we have some really, really cool things in store for you in 2019. It's a great time to jump aboard and become a patron of the Studcast. But Ron, let's get back to Florida. You set things up with Dusty, and obviously this is something going on and in play, and we'll discuss it further in the weeks ahead. But what are you doing in Florida in February of 74?
Well, you know, I'm working quite a bit there now. Things have picked up for me in the state of Florida because Watts is starting to have some influence on the book. During that month, I've got two tag matches I have with Tex McKenzie as a partner. And I'm going to come back and tell a couple of stories about Tex that I just can't avoid. They're really, really good. But let me finish the rest of these. I've got those two tags with Tex McKenzie. I have a tag match with Great Malenko as a partner. I have one with Mike Graham as a partner, which I really, really enjoyed because Mike and I at this point have been friends since we were early teenage years. Because our dads had such a great relationship and we got together and did things together quite a bit between the 60, early 60s up into 1970. So then I have two tag matches with Bill Watts. And one of those you currently see on YouTube that's out with against the Texan and the Psycho. Pretty decent matches. And two Florida title matches with champion Buddy Colt. Both of them are going to end up in disqualifications. Colt saving his belt as long as he can, because at this point, I'm getting to be pretty darn good. And then I'm going to have a single match with Harley Race in Tampa on February 12th, 1974. At this point, Harley's lost the title to Jack Briscoe, and it's obviously it's a non-title bout. And I kind of believe, you know, when I see that I'm wrestling Harley, I'm wondering, you know, how could that happen? Why would he want to come to Tampa and be on the same card with Jack as the new world champion? And then I got to thinking, well, maybe it's because when he was booked for Tampa, he was the world heavyweight champion. And if he pulls out now, you know, he wants to keep a good status in Florida because I think he's sharp enough to know that, he's got a good opportunity to get that belt back again if he treats everybody well and he shows up and works with me in Tampa on that February 12th, 1974 card. There's two stories I really want to tell, and this is Gary Hart is in one of them, and he's in this one. He's in this studcast anyway, and it's a cage match in which Gary Hart is placed in a cage. Brute Bernard is in the ring, and Tex McKenzie is wrestling Brute Bernard with his manager, Gary Hart, suspended in a cage above the ring. And when they put the cage up, they don't raise it as high as they should because, you know, Tex is pretty tall. He's darn near my height. He's about 6'8 or so. So when Tex struts down there as he does and those legs all reaching up there, trying, you know, he's a big star in Australia. He really gets over in Australia. He gets into the ring and Brute isn't in the ring yet. So when he gets there, he's in the ring, and up above him in the cage is Gary Hart. And Gary tells me the story. He says that Tex, because he looks down and the cage is really close to Tex, his head, his height. And so he's close enough that Tex gets hold of the cage and he rocks it back and he swings that cage way out over the crowd. And Gary says he wanted to kill him. He scared the hell out of him. You know, he's like, wow, gosh, man, what a nut goofball thing to do. Well, when Tex does it and he swings that big cage with Hart in it out over the crowd, he turns his back and throws his hands up in the air so that the crowd can react. And then they're reacting. They're screaming, look out, look out. And the cage comes back and hits him in the back of the head, turns him a flip, knocks him cold. And they have to go down and carry him out, and somebody else goes and takes his match. So, I mean, you know, that's a pretty odd thing to have happen to you. And so I have another one, and some of the boys were telling me there when I was there, and Tex was a clumsy guy. He didn't have great wrestling skills, and he was very clumsy. And they're on a plane, and whoever told me this story said they were on a plane, and Tex goes back, and he goes into the rear lavatory back there, and he's got to do number two, right? He's got to take him one, and so he gets his pants down, and he's about to sit down, and they hit some turbulence, and he loses his balance. And he puts his arm back to catch himself, but his hand goes down inside the toilet and he breaks his thumb. But it bends backwards and he starts screaming automatically. And when he breaks his thumb, at the same time, his wallet falls out of his pants into the commode and he falls back against the flush button on the wall and it flushes his wallet down the toilet. Right? So now he's got. And it turns his hand blue because his hand's still down in there. When his toilet goes down, then the blue stuff in the toilet comes up, and it looks like dye on his hand. Now he's got a broken thumb. He's got the blue hand. He's got his toilet, his wallet in the toilet, and he just grabs the door to the restroom, and he doesn't pull his pants up. He steps out in the back of the plane, and all the boys, they hear him back there. He goes, stewardess, stewardess. The whole plane, everybody turns and looks. Now, he's standing there holding his hand. His thumb is broken in the wrong direction. He's screaming for the stewardess. He's got his pants down around his knees. And guys were just like, oh, my gosh almighty. Everybody, all the boys in the crew were like, oh, man, I can't believe this. So when they finally get him off the plane, they had to wait there. Guys couldn't get to the town. They couldn't leave and catch their cabs and stuff and get on the bus until he was able to have them drain the toilet and get back his wallet for him. And when he got his wallet back, all of his money, all of his driver's license, every document that he had in his wallet were blue, just like the toilet water on an airplane. And so Tex had a little bit of a rough time in Australia, and Tex was a little bit of a difficult guy to work with in the ring. I'm going to work with him in Memphis in 1975 work against him. And that's an experience for any wrestler, I'd say.
Well, let me ask you about that, because Tex McKenzie is someone who got over big time as a babyface everywhere he went. And if you go back and you watch footage, I apologize if his family's listening, but he was horrible in the ring, just horrible there in the ring. Clumsy is a good word, too. What did the boys in the back say when they had to work with Tex, or when Tex was having a match? What was the consensus in the locker room of his work?
Oh, it's lots of guys, when they go in, they don't remember who they're working with, because you do your interviews on Wednesdays, and you do so many interviews for so many different towns, you forget who's on the card, and you're not concerned about it. But guys would come in, and I was always Watts is there during this time frame where he's wrestling partners with me. And when guys would ask, who are we working with? And he would say, Tex. Then you would get a reaction. You could watch. You could see it in their face if it wasn't just blurted out. Oh, no, not Tex. You know, they'd drop their head. And it was kind of like just a bad deal for a lot of people. They did not like working with him. But Tex got over, I believe, because he was such a nice guy. He just has had a tremendous outgoing personality. He had a way of dealing with fans, and I've seen him around them. Fans loved him. They didn't care whether he could wrestle or not. He just, if he got to talk to a fan, that fan is going to be a lifelong fan of his, because he just had that type of personality.
Let's get back to the show you briefly mentioned before, Ron. Tampa, February 12th, 1974. What else happened on that show?
Well, I want to go through that whole card because, gosh, this is a great example of what is happening in Florida in mid-February of 1974. This card right here, to me, is it really tells the story. The first match is Paul Jones, who has been there for a while now. He's been the Southern Heavyweight Champion. He's been the Florida Heavyweight Champion. Now he's first match. He's relegated down, and he's working with a guy called the Jackal, and that happens to be Gary Hart wearing a mask. They send him in there wearing a mask. Now, I don't know from Bill Watts why he had that concept, why he wanted to do that exactly, but that's your opening match, Paul Jones and Gary Hart under a mask. Second match was Danny Hodge, and he's going to be leaving in the next week against Tony Romano. Mike Graham and Kevin Sullivan versus the Texan, who is the future Austin Idol, and Rip Hawk. Harley Race going to wrestle me. Stan Vachon and Dick Slater are going to wrestle against Joe LeDuc and his brother Paul LeDuc for the Florida Tag Team Championships. And the LeDucs are going to... They are the champions that night, and they're going to lose their belts that night. They're never going to get those belts back again. And it's not long till Joe's brother, Paul, is going to be gone from the territory. Florida Heavyweight Championship that night, Buddy Colt defeats, guess who? Tex McKenzie. And in the main event, the newly crowned World Heavyweight Champion, Jack Briscoe, is wrestling against Dusty Rhodes. And that event ends up in a no disqualification. And I would imagine that Dusty's a heel here. And I would imagine that Dusty, I have no idea what that finish was, but I'm pretty darn sure that Dusty does something pretty dastardly. He has a lot of heat at this point in the territory. And I think that's all done on purpose. It's trying to get him the maximum amount of heat, so that when you do that turn, he's going to get the maximum amount of benefit out of that heat. So that card's just a small example of where it all seems to be heading in 1974 in the Florida territory. Some great matches there, some great talent there. And and the match I have with Harley is a Broadway 30 minutes. Doesn't hurt me. It doesn't hurt Harley. We have a really, really good match. And it's a great card and a great night as part of a great territory that's just going to get much, much better.
Now, this period of time, Ron, in February of 1974, you are still working in St. Louis, correct?
Yes, I'm still doing some shows in St. Louis. But I'm being pulled out of there a lot. I'm going to be in St. Louis. In fact, in February, I'm going to go be only there two times. I have been there as many as six, sometimes eight times in a month previously. But I'm going to be there on February 1st. I'm going to be in a six-man tag with a guy named Angus Campbell, who I don't think most people probably know. And I'm also going to be partners with what I considered as a young man in that match, one of the legends, Bobo Brazil. I had never wrestled partners or against Bobo. It was a real honor and a pleasure to be on the team with him. And we're going to wrestle against Baron Cicluna, Dick Murdoch, talked about already, and Bill Miller, Big Bill Miller. Great six-man tag in the St. Louis house show. Really easy match. Bobo's really over big time. I'm over pretty good at that point, too. And Angus is, they're trying to push Angus to try to get him over. The second time, the only other time in that month of February that I'm going to wrestle in St. Louis is going to be on TV. And it's actually the next day. And it's in another six-man tag, except my partners this time is Angus again and Kit Conway. And we're going to wrestle against Tokyo Joe, Hans Schmidt, and Big Bill Miller. These are the only two matches I'm going to have in St. Louis for the entire month. And what is happening here is I have been going there consistently for almost 2 years now, been really pushed there. Watts wants me to focus on Florida. Watts wants me in Florida. He's not willing to do what Louis was doing for me and saying, well, St. Louis is where you're going to make a big name. You're going to get to wrestle a lot of different people. It's going to benefit you a lot more than wrestling here in Florida. Bill's focus is on drawing money and on making Florida a monster territory in 1974. He thinks, and thank goodness for it, he likes me, and he thinks that I'm a great worker. He wants to work with me as a tag team, and he's going to turn on me to get heat on himself when he gets ready to turn himself heel. I think Bill is a better heel than he was as a babyface, and Bill realizes that. And that's what his plans are for me. And he doesn't want me spending my time in St. Louis. It's not going to help the Florida cards any. And he kind of shuts that down for me. I'm still going to be going to St. Louis some there because I think Sam is just pushing for it, but not to the extent I was when Louis was there and in 1973.
Let's get some listener questions on the show, Ron. We haven't done this in a while. I have a few here. And this first one is from Todd Flynn in Sevierville, Tennessee?
Sevierville.
Sevierville.
Just outside Gatlinburg, between Gatlinburg and Knoxville, Tennessee. Little town called Sevierville.
Was it the brilliance of Bill Watts and the way he turned Dusty babyface that blew Florida wide open in 1974? Or was it just a particular angle that he used? Or do you think Dusty would have been a hit in Florida no matter who or how he turned babyface?
That's a good question. And it's a two-parter. I'm going to answer the second part first, whether I think Dusty would have been a hit in Florida no matter who or how. Yes, I think Dusty, yes, would have been a hit, and it would have been a good thing to do for the territory. Dusty has been there for several years, and his heat as a heel is about to start to fade at some point here, and it's time to do it. If you're going to turn him, it's the time to do it. It was in 1974. Now, the brilliance of the way he turned him, the way Watts turned Dusty Babyface, is that's a big part of the formula. It's you know, you can do it in a great way and it's going to be big for you for a long, long time. Or if you do it half ass and it doesn't get over, then you have killed one of your best heels and you may not have had benefited your territory at all by what you did. So I really believe it was a great angle, and it was made even more significant by how it was done and who it involved. And the reason I say who it involved is because Watts made it possible by involving Gary Hart to get a much longer run. If Dusty gets over, if you just got one guy that turns on you and you start as a babyface, what do you do after you run through your program with that one guy? And Watts is smart here. He's not, this angle is not just for Gary Hart. It's not just for Pac Song. It's not just for Bobby Duncombe. It's not just for the Korean Assassin. It is based around Dusty turning babyface and then having Gary Hart with a stable full of badass heels that Dusty can whip their ass one after another and take months and months to get through all of those programs. And that, to me, is the beauty of what happened in 1974. This wasn't a short-term explosion of a territory that's going to wane within a few months. It was a huge explosion in the territory that's going to last for a long, long time.
Ron, our next question here was sent in by Richard Bunt in Ragland, Alabama. Really enjoyed your studcast about the top 10 things that make a successful promotion. Just one question. Who would you say were your top 5 referees in Southeastern and Continental Wrestling?
Oh, that's a great question right there. It makes me, I got to take just a second here to give that a little bit of thought, because I had a lot of referees. And now I'm going to do this probably in no particular order, but Ronnie West is just, one of the greatest referees anyone had in any territory, anywhere in the world. And he had more skills than just being a referee. He could find towns for you. He could promote for you. There were so many things. Ronnie West being in your company was such a benefit to it. I'd say he's probably number one because he wasn't just a referee. The second one, that I would say is Mac McMurray. And that a lot of that has to do with Mac was a great referee, always reliable, always very, very good with finishes back and forth from dressing room to dressing room. But he helped me buy Knoxville. If it hadn't been for him, I would have never probably had a start as a wrestling promoter and never experienced the things I did in my life. Larry Brock is a referee from Dothan, Alabama, that wrestled throughout the Southeastern and Continental days, mostly in that Dothan area, Panama City, and cities close to the Southeastern part of Alabama. And Larry Brock was a tremendous referee. And he was one of those guys that every once in a while I would hit him with a wraparound. And, he would end up in the fourth row. I don't know how he took the bumps he took without killing himself. Another one is a guy named Nick Dukas that refereed for me for about a year and a half. Did an excellent job. Very, very good. And the fifth one, I'd have to say the fifth one is Tommy Weathers. And that brings to mind a story. Tommy Weathers is a small guy. He liked to drink. He wasn't an alcoholic, but he liked to drink before the matches when he was working, and he could drink after the matches. He probably only weighed 150 pounds. He might have only been 5'7", 150 pounds. He could drink more beer than any guy that weighed 300 pounds I ever saw. And I remember running a spot show just north of Mobile, Alabama, and Tommy Weathers lived in Chattanooga, Tennessee. He drove from Chattanooga almost to Mobile, Alabama, probably that's 500, close to 500 miles, to Monroeville, Alabama. That's the name of the town. This came to me. And Tommy referees the match. And the next night we're going to be in Dothan. So he's by himself. He's driven all the way. So I say, Tommy, let me ride with you, man. Ride back over to Dothan with you. And he was like, oh, yeah, that'd be great, Ron. So I get in the car with my referee, with Tommy. And we start out. And so he's been drinking, you know, but it wasn't unusual. He'd had some beers. So, you know, and I asked him about halfway between Monroeville, Alabama and Dothan, Alabama. It's probably 150 miles. I say, how many beers you had today, Tommy? And he goes, oh, Ron, let me see. I'm going to try to add them up. And he's thinking, I think I've had about 20, you know. And I'm like, gosh, are you kidding, man? So, no, he goes, and I couldn't tell he'd had five. I mean, you know, he was driving just fine. And anyway, we go through this little town of Op, Alabama, and the policemen stop us. And they pull him over. He pulls over, and they come to his window. And they say, could you get out of the car, please? And he gets out. And they said, can we see your license? And he gives him his license. And the officer says, have you been drinking? Now I can hear the conversation. They're standing up in front of the car, but I can hear what's going on. Got the windows down. And he says, have you been drinking? And Tommy says, yeah, I've had a few beers. And the policeman says, how many beers have you had? And Tommy says, maybe 23, 24. To the policeman. I'm like, oh, come on. So the policeman goes, oh, he goes, wait a minute. He goes, are you serious? Yeah, Tommy's being very nice and being very honest. Yeah, I have. And the policeman, there's two of them. So one says, pull out your breathalyzer. They have a little tube that you blow into, and it tells you what your alcohol content is. And so and it's a little glass tube. It's probably about 2 inches long, very thin. And he holds it up. Tommy holds it up to his mouth. The cop says, hold this up to your mouth and breathe in it, blow in it. So when he blows in it, the bottom of the tube flies off in the policeman's face. And I'm like, I watch it. And the policeman, oh, he backs off. He's like, trying to get it from his face. Hey, did that cut me? He's asking, did that cut me? You know, and the guy says, no. The other policeman, no. And he goes, have you ever seen that happen? Now they're talking to each other. He says, have you ever seen that happen before? And the other one goes, no, I haven't, man. He goes, get another one of those. So he brings out another one. And he says, blow in this one. And Tommy, pow. I mean, he pours the bottom out of that one, too. So they're like, oh, man, you've got to go to jail, you know. And so then while they're in the process then of getting ready to haul him off, one of them looks through the window at me and he recognizes me. And he comes on my side of the car and he goes, did you know he was drinking like that? And I said, yeah, he drinks all the time, you know, but he drove fine. He had no problem. I was watching him. He's having no problem. He's been doing great driving. And he says, the policeman says, can you drive the car? And I said, well, of course. He said, have you had anything to drink? No. And I hadn't. You know, I didn't drink after matches. And the policeman says, can you drive? I said, yeah, I can drive. And he says, I'll tell you what. He says, I'm going to let him go if you'll get over there and drive him to wherever y'all going. He said, you're going to go to Dothan. You're wrestling in Dothan. He knew the schedule. And I said, yeah, that's where we're going. So I get in the car and I drive Tommy on to Dothan. But I get to see him blow the bottom out of two of those test tubes. And gosh, what a drinking little son of a gun he was.
One final question here this week, Ron. This is from Joseph Johnson in Vancouver, Canada. How many territories do you think ever reached the plateau of their company that the Florida territory did in 1974? And which ones were they?
Man, that's another good one. That requires a little bit of thought, too. I don't know that anybody. I've never seen any. Well, first of all, I can't speak for a lot of other territories. He's asking if I know a lot of others that did the same thing. I worked Georgia. I went to Florida, spent 4 years in Florida. I went to Knoxville, started my own company, and wrestled for myself the rest of my career. So I can't talk about a whole lot of companies, but I do know that it was just what happened in 1974 when Dusty makes the turn is just remarkable. We had a very similar year in 1983 with Southeastern prior to being Continental. The year that I wrestled Ric Flair for the world title, and Bob Armstrong was the special referee in the match, and ends up turning on me in the match, and they end up putting me in a hospital. Had my third knee operation. Just a really, really horrible night for me. From that comes Bob Armstrong, just the opposite heel, is just the opposite type of angle is what happened with Dusty. Dusty turned from heel to babyface. Bob, for the first time in his life and his career, is going to go from being a babyface to a heel. And not only is he going to do it well, he is going to do it fantastically. I mean, Bob, I watched television every week from my home with my knees still being healing for months and months. And it was the biggest explosion in Southeastern that ever happened, Knoxville or Pensacola, when Bob turned heel. And it kept going for that entire summer. After I started back, it didn't make any difference who he wrestled during that 6 months or 7 months that I was off and unable to wrestle. Every town was selling out everywhere. And then once I came back, I mean, that's what fans, you know, they had been wondering, am I ever going to be able to wrestle again? Much less get my hands on Bob Armstrong. And I was able to do that. And so I would say, it would have to be 1983 in my own territory. If I had worked a lot of other places, I might have seen other things in that realm. But that would be my answer. Yeah, 1983 in my own territory, Southeastern Wrestling out of Pensacola.
It's been a while since we've done this on the show, but the way it works is you pick the question, and the one you pick gets a special gift from the Tennessee Stud. So which question is your winner this week?
I kind of like the Vancouver question here. I mean, you know, that's a good question. If I had been into more territories, I would have probably had a better answer for it. But that's a great question. And, you know, what I really like about all three of these questions is they all have something to do with the last two studcasts that we just finished, those 10 steps to having a championship territory, to really blowing things up. And, whoever picked these are great questions because they just fit really good with the last two episodes. In case people haven't heard those two, I think obviously these fans really got inspired by them. And I thank all three of these. And I look forward to doing more of these. We've kind of gotten away from them sometimes, I think, Brian, because the content to the Studcast of just increasing. I'm getting better at what I do, and I just found a way to encompass more stories within what I do. And, you know, I'm hoping people are enjoying it. But I think we're going to go with Joseph Johnson. I believe that was his name, from Vancouver.
As we wrap things up, we want to remind you could become friends with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook. The page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can follow the Tennessee Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last, and you can listen to me on the 605 Super Podcast, available at 605pod.com or wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts, classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. The next Super Studcast debuts on Tuesday, January 15th for patrons of the Studcast, available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. It will be all about the Knoxville, Tennessee wrestling war of 1979. Maybe the bloodiest wrestling war there ever was, and certainly one that people have been waiting to hear the Tennessee Studs take on, and you will once and for all on the Super Studcast. Once again, Tuesday, January 15th, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. We also want to remind you that Ron has just put out the first 5-pack of Southeastern and Continental Wrestling DVDs, The Lost Territory, the collector's edition, now available at tnstud.com. Just go to the Stud store and they are there. And remember, shipping included. No one does that except the Tennessee Stud. But Ron, anything you want to say about these DVDs? I know we've been talking about them on the last several episodes, but is there anything more you'd like to say to the listeners about this fine DVD set?
Well, they've just now started to arrive. with people that have ordered them, and I'm already getting great responses, and I really anticipated it. I watched all five of these, this first edition. Gosh, it just took me back. The memories are just unbelievable. I realized what a great product we had back in those days. And this, some of this is Southeastern, some of it is Continental, some of it's Gordon Solie from Birmingham, some of it is Charlie Platt out of Dothan for Southeastern. It's just phenomenal stuff. It's got Hulk Hogan against Andre the Giant from a arm wrestling contest turns into a brawl. First time I ever saw Andre bleed. I mean, it's just really, really, it's got a lot of everything in it. Bonus footage, matches from early 1970s that just blow me away. I think people are going to really enjoy it. Comments are great already. And yeah, if you want one of those, you can just go to tnstud.com, click on the old stud store, be the first thing you see. It's only $39.99. And as you say, we're going to pay the shipping for you. I don't know where you can get five DVDs, 12 hours of total action in those. And really proud of that.
Ron, before we wrap things up, where are we going next week?
Well, we're going to stay in Florida. I mean, why get away from it now? I mean, it's cranking, and I really want to do justice to what happens in Florida in 1974. We're going to be in the month of March, and we're going to be talking about things as the territory continues to keep moving upward at the box office and in the arenas. And I'm going to become the Florida heavyweight champion. And I'm going to be one of the few that's going to ever hold all three of the major titles in Florida. That's going to happen in the month of March, and fans, just come on back. We're going to make history, and I think what's going to happen in 1974 is just going to leave fans talking, and something that's never going to happen again, and something that I don't think they're going to forget once they hear about it.
Ron Fuller Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.